9 of the clock, sir," Kelly entered, sucking his yellow teeth. The women trundled in after him with their cart. Gaudy paper labels declared each ceramic bottle to contain Condi's patent oxygenating deodorizer, 1 imperial gallon. "What's all this?"
"Manganate of soda, sir, to see to the palace plumbing. We plan to flush every closet, clear the palace pipes out, straight down to the main drains."
Mallory adjusted his robe.
It embarrassed him to appear with his feet and ankles bared before the charwomen.
"Kelly, it won't do a dashed bit of good if you flush your pipes straight to hell. This is metropolitan London in a wretched hot summer. Even the Thames stinks."
"Have to do something, sir," Kelly said. "Our guests are complaining most vigorously. I can't say as I blame them, sir."
The women funneled a jug of the decoction, which was bright purple, into the bowl of Mallory's water closet. The deodorizer emitted a piercing, ammoniacal reek, far more vile in its own way than the lingering taint in his rooms. They scrubbed wearily at the porcelain, sneezing until Kelly pulled the cistern chain with a magisterial gesture. Then they left, and Mallory dressed. He checked his notebook. The afternoon's schedule was crowded, but the morning had only a single appointment. Mallory had already learned that Disraeli's tardiness made it best to allot him half the day. With luck, he might find time to take his jacket in for French cleaning, or have a barber trim the clots from his hair. When he went down to the dining room, 2 other late breakfasters were chatting over tea. One was a cabinet man named Belshaw, the other a museum underling whose name might be Sydenham. Mallory couldn't quite recall. Belshaw looked up as Mallory entered the room. Mallory nodded civilly. Belshaw gazed back at him with barely concealed astonishment. Mallory walked past the 2 men, taking his customary seat beneath the gilt gas chandelier. Belshaw and Sydenham began to talk in low, urgent tones. Mallory was nonplussed. He had never been formally introduced to Belshaw, but could the man possibly resent a simple nod? Now Sydenham, his pudgy face gone pale, was casting sidelong glances at Mallory. Mallory wondered if his fly was open. It was not. But the men's eyes goggled with apparently genuine alarm. Had his wound opened? Was his hair dripping blood down his neck? It did not seem so. Mallory gave his breakfast order to a waiter. The servant's face, too, was wooden, as if the choice of kippers and eggs were a grave indiscretion. Mallory, growing steadily more confused, had a mind to confront Belshaw on the matter, and began to rehearse a little speech, but Belshaw and Sydenham rose suddenly, quitting their tea, and left the dining room. Mallory ate his breakfast with grim deliberation, determined not to let the incident upset him. He went to the front desk to fetch his basket of mail. The usual desk clerk was not on duty, taken down with a catarrh of the lungs, his replacement said. Mallory retired with his basket to his customary seat in the library. There were 5 of his palace colleagues present, gathered in a corner of the room, where they were anxiously conversing. As Mallory glanced up, he thought he caught them staring at him. But this was nonsense. Mallory sorted through his correspondence with desultory interest, his head aching slightly and his mind already drifting. There was a tedious burden of necessary professional correspondence, and the usual tiresome freight of admiring missives and begging letters. Perhaps the engagement of a personal secretary might in fact be unavoidable. Struck by an odd inspiration, Mallory wondered if young Mr. Tobias of the Central Statistics Bureau might not be just the man for this post. Perhaps an offer of alternate employment would increase the fellow's daring in the office, for there was much at the Bureau that Mallory longed to peruse. The file on Lady Ada, for instance, should such a fabulous item exist. Or the slippery Mr. Oliphant, with his ready smiles and vague assurances. Or Lord Charles Lyell, the medal-heavy savant chief of the Uniformitarian faction. These 3 worthies were likely well above his reach, Mallory thought, but he might well ferret out a bit of data on Peter Falk, a sinister rascal whose web of underhanded intrigue was ever more manifest. He would have it all out somehow. Mallory felt quite sure of that, as he shuffled through his mail basket. The whole occulted business would slowly emerge, like bones chipped from their bed of shale. He had glimpsed the closeted skeletons of the Rad elite. Now, given time and a chance to work, he would wrench the mystery whole from its stony matrix. His attention was caught by a most unusual packet. It was of non-standard dimensions, rather blocky and square, and it bore a colourful set of French express stamps. The ivory-yellow envelope, astonishingly slick and stiff, was a most unusual waterproof substance, something like isinglass. Mallory took out his Sheffield knife, selected the smallest of several blades, and worried the thing open. The interior bore a single French engine card of the Napoleon gauge. Mallory, with growing alarm, shook the card free onto the tabletop. He did this with some difficulty, for the slick interior of the envelope was queerly damp. It was dewy with a chemical moisture, giving off an increasingly virulent stench as it was exposed to air. The card, a blank without holes, bore a neat block of tiny black print, all in capitals. "To Dr. Edward Mallory, Palace of Paleontology, London. You are in guilty possession of a property stolen at Epsom. You will return this property to us, whole and complete, following the orders given you in the personal notices column of the London Daily Express. Until we receive this property, you will suffer a variety of deliberate punishments, culminating, if necessary, in your entire and utter destruction. Edward Mallory, we know your number, your identity, your history, and your ambitions. We are fully cognizant of your every weakness. Resistance is useless. Swift and complete submission is your only hope. Captain Swing." Mallory sat in astonishment, memory rushing vividly upon him. Wyoming again, a morning when he'd risen from his camp bed to find a rattlesnake dozing in his body heat. He had felt the serpent squirming below his back in the depths of his sleep, but had drowsily ignored it. Here now was the sudden, scaly proof. He snatched the card up, examining it minutely. Camphorated cellulose, damp with something pungent, and the tiny black letters were beginning to fade. The flexible card had grown hot in his fingers. He dropped it at once, choking back a yelp of surprise. The card lay, warping, on the tabletop, then began flaking into layers thinner than the finest onion skin, while browning nastily at the edges. A feather of yellowish smoke began to rise, and Mallory realized that the thing was about to burst into flame. He snatched hastily within the basket, came up with the latest thick grey issue of the Quarterly Journal Geological Society, and swiftly swatted the card. After two sharp blows it came apart into a thready, curling mess, half mixed with the blistered finish of the tabletop. Mallory slit open a begging letter, tossed the contents out unread, and swept the ash into the envelope with the sharp-edged spine of the Geological Journal. The table did not seem too badly damaged.
"Dr. Mallory?"
Mallory looked up, with a guilt-stricken start, into the face of a stranger. The man, a tall and clean-shaven Londoner, very plainly dressed, with a gaunt, unsmiling look, stood across the library table from Mallory, papers and a notebook in one hand. "A very poor specimen," Mallory said, in a sudden ecstasy of impromptu deception. "Pickled in camphor. A dreadful technique." He folded the envelope and slid it in his pocket. The stranger silently offered a carte de visite. Ebenezer Fraser's card bore his name, a telegram number, and a small embossed seal of state. Nothing else. The other side offered a stippled portrait with a look of stone-faced gravity that seemed the man's natural expression. Mallory rose to offer his hand, then realized that his fingers were tainted with acid. He bowed instead, sat at once, and wiped his hand furtively on the back of his trouser leg. The skin of thumb and forefinger felt desiccated, as if dipped in formaldehyde.
"I hope I find you well, sir," Fraser murmured, seating himself across the table. "Recovered from yesterday's attack?"
Mallory glanced down the length of the library. The other patrons were still clumped together at the far side of the room, and seemed very curious indeed about his antics and Fraser's sudden appearance.
"A trifle," Mallory hedged. "Might happen to anyone in London."
Fraser lifted one dark eyebrow by a fraction.
"Sorry my mishap should cause you to take trouble, Mr. Fraser." "No trouble, sir."
Fraser opened a leather-bound notebook and produced a reservoir pen from within his plain, Quakerish jacket.
"Some questions?" "Truth to tell, I'm rather pressed for time at the moment."
Fraser silenced him with an impassive look.
"Been here 3 hours, sir, awaiting your convenience."
Mallory began a fumbling apology. Fraser ignored him.
"I witnessed something quite curious outside, at 6 o'clock this morning, sir. A young newsboy, crying to the world that Leviathan Mallory was arrested for murder."
"Me? Edward Mallory?"
Fraser nodded.
"I don't understand. Why should any newsboy cry any such damnable lie?" "Sold a deal of his papers," Fraser said dryly. "Bought one myself."
"What on earth did this paper have to say about me?"
"Not a word of news about any Mallory," Fraser said.
You may see for yourself.
He dropped a folded newspaper on the tabletop, a London Daily Express. Mallory set the newspaper carefully atop his basket.
Some wicked prank, he suggested, his throat dry. The street arrows here are nerved for anything.
When I stepped out again, the little rascal had hooked it, Fraser said. But a deal of your colleagues heard that newsboy crying his tale. Been the talk of the place all morning.
I see, Mallory said. That accounts for a certain... Well,
he cleared his throat. Fraser watched him impassively.
You'd best see this now, sir.
He took a folded document from his notebook, opened it, and slid it across the polished mahogany. An engine-printed daguerreotype. A dead man, full length on a slab, a bit of linen tucked about his loins. The picture had been taken in a morgue. The corpse had been knifed open from belly to sternum with a single tremendous ripping thrust. The skin of chest and legs and bulging belly was marble pale, in eerie contrast to the deeply sunburnt hands, the florid face. It was Francis Rudwick. There was a caption at the bottom of the picture. "A scientific autopsy," it read. "The Batrachian subject is pithed and open in a catastrophic dissection. First in a series."
"God in heaven," Mallory said.
"Official police morgue record," Fraser said. "Seems it fell into the hands of a mischief-maker."
Mallory stared at it in horror-struck amazement.
"What can it mean?"
Fraser readied his pen.
"What is Batrachian, sir?"
"From the Greek," Mallory blurted. "Batrachos. Amphibian. Frogs and toads, mostly." He struggled for words.
"Once, years ago, in a debate, I said that his theories... Rudwick's geological theories, you know. I heard the story this morning, sir. It seems well known among your colleagues."
Fraser flipped pages in his notebook.
"You said to Mr. Rudwick, the course of evolution does not conform to the Batrachian sluggishness of your intellect."
He paused.
"Fellow did look a bit froggy, didn't he, sir?" "I was in public debate at Cambridge," Mallory said slowly. "Our blood was up."
"Rudwick claimed you were mad as a hatter," Fraser mused. "Seems you took that remark very ill."
Mallory flushed.
"He had no right to say that, with his gentry airs. You were enemies."
"Yes, but..."
Mallory wiped his forehead.
"You can't believe I had anything to do with this."
"Not by your own intention, I'm sure," Fraser said. "But I believe you're a Sussex man, sir. Town called Lewes?"
"Yes."
"Seems that some scores of these pictures have been mailed from the Lewes postal office."
Mallory was stunned.
"Scores of them?"
"Mailed far and wide to your Royal Society colleagues, sir. Anonymously."
"Christ in heaven," Mallory said. "They mean to destroy me."
Fraser said nothing. Mallory stared at the morgue picture. Suddenly the simple human pity of the sight struck him with terrible force.
"Poor damned Rudwick. Look what they've done to him."
Fraser watched him politely.
"He was one of us," Mallory blurted, stung into angry sincerity. "He was no theorist, but a damned fine bone digger. My God, think of his poor family."
Fraser made a note. "Family. Must inquire into that. Very likely they've been told you murdered him."
"But I was in Wyoming when Rudwick was killed. Everyone knows that."
"A wealthy man might hire the business done."
"I'm not a wealthy man."
Fraser said nothing.
"I wasn't," Mallory said. "Not then."
Fraser leafed deliberately through his notebook.
"I won the money gambling."
Fraser showed mild interest.
"My colleagues have noticed how I spend it," Mallory concluded, with a chill sensation, "and wondered whence the money came. And they talk about me behind my back, eh?"
"Envy does set tongues wagging, sir."
Mallory felt a sudden giddy dread. Menace filled the air like a cloud of wasps. After a moment, in Fraser's tactful silence, Mallory rallied himself. He shook his head, slowly set his jaw. He would not be mazed or driven. There was work to do. There was evidence at hand. Mallory bent forward with a scowl and studied the picture fiercely.
"First of a series, this says. This is a threat, Mr. Fraser. It implies similar murders to follow. A catastrophic dissection. This refers to our scientific quarrel, as if he'd died because of that.
"Savants take their quarrels very seriously," Fraser said.
"Can you mean to say that my colleagues believe I sent this? That I hire assassins like a Machiavel? That I am a dangerous maniac who boasts of murdering his rivals?"
Fraser said nothing.
"My God!" Mallory said. "What am I to do?"
"My superiors have set this case within my purview," Fraser said formally. "I must ask you to trust in my discretion, Dr. Mallory."
"But what am I to do about the damage to my reputation? Am I to go to every man in this building and beg his pardon and tell him I'm not some hellish ghoul?"
"Government will not allow a prominent savant to be harassed in this manner," Fraser assured him quietly. "Tomorrow in Bow Street, the Commissioner of Police will issue a statement to the Royal Society declaring you a victim of malicious slander and innocent of all suspicion in the Rudwick affair." Mallory rubbed his beard.
"Will that help, you think?"
"If necessary, we will issue a public statement to the daily newspapers as well."
"But might not such publicity arouse more suspicion against me?"
Fraser shifted a bit in his library chair.
"Dr. Mallory, my bureau exists to destroy conspiracies. We are not without experience. We are not without our resources. We will not be trumped by some shabby clique of dark lanternists. We mean to have the lot of these plotters branch and root, and we will do it sooner, sir, if you are frank with me, and tell me all you know."
Mallory sat back in his chair.
"It is in my nature to be frank, Mr. Fraser. But it is a dark and scandalous story. You need not fear for my sensibilities."
Mallory looked about at the mahogany shelves, the bound journals, the leather-bound texts and outsized atlases. Suspicion hung in the air like a burning taint. After yesterday's street assault, the palace had seemed a welcome fortress to him, but now it felt like a badger's bolt-hole.
"This ain't the place to tell it," Mallory muttered.
"No, sir," Fraser agreed. "But you should go about your scientific business, same as always. Put a bold face on matters, and likely your enemies will think their stratagems failed." The advice seemed sound to Mallory. At the least it was action. He rose at once to his feet.
"Go about my daily business, eh? Yes, I should think so. Quite proper."
Fraser rose as well.
"I will accompany you, sir, with your permission. I trust we will put a sharp end to your troubles."
"You might not think so if you knew the whole damned business," Mallory grumbled.
"Mr. Oliphant has informed me on the matter."
"I doubt it," Mallory grunted. "He has closed his eyes to the worst of it."
"I'm no bloody politician," Fraser remarked, in his same mild tone. "Shall we be on our way, sir?"
Outside the palace, the London sky was a canopy of yellow haze. It hung above the city in gloomy grandeur, like some storm-fleshed, gelid man-o'-war. Its tentacles, the uprising filth of the city's smokestacks, twisted and fluted like candle smoke in utter stillness, to splash against a lidded ceiling of glowering cloud. The invisible sun cast a drowned and watery light. Mallory studied the street around him, a London summer morning made strange by the eerie richness of the sooty amber light.
"Mr. Fraser, you're a London man, born and bred, I take it?"
"Yes, sir."
"Have you ever seen weather like this?"
Fraser considered, squinting at the sky.
"Not since I were a lad, sir, when the coal fogs were bad. But the rads built taller stacks. Nowadays it blows off into the counties."
He paused.
"Mostly."
Mallory considered the flat clouds, fascinated. He wished he'd spent more time on the doctrines of pneumodynamics. This pot-lid of static cloud displayed an unhealthy lack of natural turbulence, as though the dynamical systematics of the atmosphere had stagnated somehow. The stinking underground, the droughty, sewage-thickened Thames, and now this.
"Doesn't seem as hot as yesterday," he muttered.
"The gloom, sir."
The streets were such a crush as only London could produce. The omnibuses and cabriolets were all taken, every intersection jammed with rattle-traps and dog-carts, with cursing drivers and panting, black-nostrilled horses. Steam-gurneys chugged sluggishly by, many towing rubber-tired freight cars loaded with provisions. It seemed the gentry's summer exodus from London was becoming a rout. Mallory could see the sense in it. It was a long walk to Fleet Street and his appointment with Disraeli. It seemed best to try the train and endure the stink. But the British Brotherhood of Sappers and Miners stood on strike at the entrance to Gloucester Road Station. They had set up pickets and banners across the walk, and were heaping sandbags, like an army of occupation. A large crowd looked on, keeping good order. They did not seem annoyed by the strikers' boldness, but seemed curious or cowed. Perhaps they were glad to see the underground shut. More likely they were simply afraid of the sandhogs. The helmeted strikers had boiled up from their underground workings like so many muscular kobolds.